You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Find productive ways to work together. There has been a lot of discussion about the difficulties that arise from time to time in the reality of Russian-European relations. I think what we want to try to do today in a relatively brief and concise conversation is to marry these two aspects and to really explore what kind of a partnership we can develop by looking at starting with a clear evaluation of the constraints. What is it that Russia can bring to the table? What is it that Europe can bring to the table? And what is it that they can't bring to the table? And see if we can, by almost method of elimination, begin to have a clearer agenda for what can be achieved in the near to midterm in Russian and European relations. It is often said, and I think generally correctly, that the fundamental essence and the foundation for Russian-European relations is economic, and that on a more granular level is fundamentally related to energy. And so that's where we're going to start today. The title of this first panel is Beyond Energy. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about energy. We're going to start from energy and we're going to move out from there. We have an excellent panel of speakers to get us started off. We're going to go in a little bit of a different order than is presented in your programs. We're going to start with my colleague to the left, Adnan Vatansever, who joined the Carnegie Endowment's Energy and Climate Program in Washington about a month ago after a distinguished career in the World Bank and Cambridge Energy Research, is an analyst with broad experience in Russian-European and Caspian region energy relations and the political economy of energy. From there, we'll move to a broader discussion of what we've learned in recent times in terms of what the structure and the possibilities of the Russian economy are in a presentation from Sergei Alexashenko, scholar in residence in the economic program at the Carnegie Moscow Center and an associate of Carnegie's Global Economic Program. Sergei is probably known to most of you. His CV would take up most of the time that we have today if I were to read it out, but just to name the highlights, in addition to his work at Carnegie, he is head of macroeconomic research at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow, former deputy governor of the Russian Central Bank, former chief economist at Merrill Lynch in Moscow, and the list goes on. And then we're going to turn to the European side and hear from Jana Dreher, trade policy analyst at ECIPE, and a longtime observer and analyst of European trade policy vis-a-vis emerging markets in Eurasia, Asia more broadly, but more specifically, Russia. So, without further ado, I will pass the floor to Adnan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam. I'd like to focus on one major question around which I'd like to form the discussion. The question is whether the possibility for cooperation on energy issues between Russia and the European Union has increased or is likely to increase in the near future. We know what the major difficulties were in at least about a year and a half ago, primarily due to gas-related crisis. But currently, I would say I would like to draw attention to three areas which I believe make it much more likely that we might see greater incentives for cooperation, at least from the perspective of Russia. The three areas that I'd like to focus are the following. The first one is one needs to look at the big picture and see what is happening to the Russian economic model, and basically to the political economy of oil and gas trends in Russia. My main conclusion is that the existing model is very much strained, and it creates incentives for Russia to become to adopt a much more cooperative stance, particularly in issues such as attracting foreign investments. Now, whether this is going to happen or not is another issue that we can talk about the constraints, but my sense is that the incentives are the right incentives are to some extent there now. The second area is it has to do with gas, which has been the main source of contention between the two sides. And I see certain trends that make cooperation again much more likely than before. And the third area is an area which is emerging increasingly important from Moscow's perspective, and this is energy efficiency. It is its rediscovered focus on energy efficiency is basically an area that is much less controversial than anything that has been there so far in bilateral or Russian relations with the West, Russia's energy relations, and this could be an area where opportunities might arise. So let me start with the first topic, basically the political economy of rent distribution or oil and gas rent distribution in Russia. Just to summarize how it looked like so far, I would like to give a very simplistic model. It is a huge amount of rents have been generated, and they are mainly distributed between the companies as profits. Another part goes for reinvestment in order to sustain a particular production level, and the third part of the rents has been going to the government. Now, looking at the past decade, before the period before the crisis when oil prices collapsed, Russia witnessed two major trends, especially in the first part of the decade. This was a huge growth of oil production, and at the same time, a massive increase in the price of oil, and by association, the price of gas. This resulted in a considerable increase in the total amount of rents which was able to satisfy an existing model of rent allocation. This was, in this case, companies were getting more. They did have quite strong funds to invest in their fields, and government was increasing its revenues substantially, actually a colossal increase in government revenues within a span of a decade until the global recession hit. Now, this model has become increasingly strained currently, and this is not just because of oil prices. The future of oil prices will be key about where this model will evolve, but if we assume that the current prices are pretty much what we might see on average for the next few years, or even for a decade, and I'm basing my assumptions on the fact that at least the last recession has shown that there is a certain limit about where prices could go without damaging the global economy. So we might, even if we see higher prices, it will be cyclical again to some extent. So on the one hand, if we assume at current prices, Russia's economic model is going to be increasingly strained very much because of geological reasons. Now, it is most industry insiders would note that for Russia, basically, there are two big problems. On one side, the problem is on the old and mature fields where costs are increasing rapidly. And production, for instance, in oil has been declining since 2007 in West Siberia. And in the meantime, costs have been growing rapidly, and it has actually accelerated last year based on various data. Now, the gas sector doesn't look too different in terms of its mature fields too. What is happening is that in each case, as the costs are increasing, there is much less money left for reinvestment or for the government as well. The other trend is there has been a gradual shift towards new fields, but new fields naturally require much larger investment, much bigger amounts of and much bigger commitment by companies. So we would expect that the amount for reinvestment, even to maintain current production levels, will have to increase. And if we assume a similar external conditions in terms of pricing, this is actually going to strain very much the current economic model that has developed there. There will be less for the government, and the government basically will feel an incentive that something needs to be done in this area for reinvestment. Now, this is an area where the problem could be tackled by a better tax regime or also by promoting independent gas producers or small companies, but each of them, I guess, could lead to some favorable circumstances for foreign investors as well. But in general, my sense is that there is much stronger incentive from Russia's perspective to elaborate its stance towards foreign potential foreign investors in its oil and gas fields. Certainly, there are some major constraints that we can talk about, and that actually leads to uncertainty whether Russia will still act on these incentives or just prefer to postpone acting on them. And I guess one of the major constraints is the foreign investment law from 2008, which describes a huge range of areas as strategic. Oil and gas is among them, and it has now. There are certain signs that Russia is actually rethinking its strategy in that area, and this is there have been like hundreds of projects that have been submitted for approval for the Commission that approves foreign investments, which is headed by Prime Minister Putin. And there has been a huge backlog, and there is a realization that this system is not working anymore. So this is, Prime Minister Putin has been actually making statements that the country needs to revise its stance on this. And several months ago, he invited some of the major executives of oil and gas companies, foreign oil and gas companies, to Salihar, for instance, and making statements which sounded much more positive than what we had seen in for at least since the Yukos affair, I would say. Now, certainly there will be other constraints as well, which is Russia has some big players that will have interest in maintaining the current system, such as Gazprom and Rosneft have been assigned to develop the big fields or whatever is discovered as a big field. Will the Russian government change its stance on this topic? I mean, it has the incentive to do so in order to recreate this potential for reinvestment, but we are not sure how soon. I'm not sure how soon the Russian government will act on that. Now, the second area that I'd like to talk about is specifically about the gas sector. Now, I'm looking from the perspective of Gazprom and how Gazprom is actually is likely to see what is happening in the gas sector. Now, there is a global, at least for now, glut for in the gas market. There is a reason to think that there is an oversupply, and it will last at least until the European recovery of demand picks up some speed. Even though this might be happening, there is still some gap compared to the period before the crisis. Now, the other thing is that the other thing has to do with some strategic mistakes on part of Gazprom in the past decade. For instance, Gazprom was very late in entering into the game for LNG exports. It was as late as, say, 2003 when they decided to move in that area. And they should have done it much earlier in order to lock in several countries or contracts in that area. And now it becomes increasingly harder to do so, partly because of the unconventional gas revolution in the U.S. It has shifted a lot of LNG tankers to the other side of the Atlantic basin. And in the Pacific basin, the competition is heating up because of Australian LNG, for instance. So this is an area where Gazprom is witnessing major difficulties. The other problem is that it had a major failure in establishing its gas relationship with China as a potential big importer of its own gas. After talking for over the decades, simply nothing has been achieved there. There have been serious disagreements about price, and in the meantime, China was able to establish a link with Central Asian gas, with Turkmenistan mainly. And it has signed contracts for LNG, so its need for Russian gas is, compared to a decade ago, it is much more questionable, and there are indications that China may not need Russian gas for at least a decade. So in this case, for Gazprom, the European market appears as the main market where it would be concentrating its efforts. And this actually, to some extent, weakens also its negotiating position because it has to sell the gas that it is producing, and Europe appears as the most cost-effective market to do so. So that, to some extent, makes me think that that Gazprom might be willing to adopt much more cooperative stance. But there are certain constraints that need to be recognized, of course, where things might be headed. Now, the first thing is, and these are much longer term issues, the first thing is that if we think about gas, it used to be a bridge for cooperation between Russia and the European Union for several decades until very recently. Now, it has become a source of conflict and discontent on both parts much more recently. Partly this has to do with the fact that gas has become an increasingly important source of energy for the European Union, unlike two or three decades ago. And the European Union naturally has to think about gas in a much more strategic way. It has much more important role in its own energy security calculations. So this is just one of the longer-term constraints that I would mention. And the other thing is, in the meantime, Gazprom has increased its appetite for taking over other companies abroad or taking over various assets abroad. And this has run into a major problem simply because of lack of legal correspondence between Europe and between Gazprom. There is no indication that Russia is soon going to shift towards adopting towards agreeing to the third directive of the European Union. There are issues which the European Union is expecting from Russia, and Russia is probably not likely to deliver them in the very near future. And this is a major constraint. And another area is one thing that gives some hope probably is Russia's rapprochement with Ukraine, recent rapprochement. But again, one needs to think about some larger structural constraints there. As long as Ukraine does not improve its energy efficiency, as long as Ukraine does not increase its gas prices, it will face some repeated problems. Naftohaz will not have easy time repaying its bills, its gas bills, and it will not be surprising if it does not increase its domestic gas prices. It will not be surprising if it faces another series of difficulties in the future in its relations with Gazprom. So there are certain constraints that remain there, but at least to some extent, a major strain in gas relations between EU and Russia is probably less likely to be caused by Ukraine, at least for some time, given the current situation. And finally, regarding gas, I'd like to note that I assume that in the upcoming months, the competition between Caspian gas and Russian gas will only heat up. It's not going to disappear. The competition between South Stream and Nabucco, I have in mind in particular, some important decisions need to be made in the forthcoming months or at least a year. And this is something that this will create the sense of an ongoing tough competition rather than a sense for cooperation. Now, the last area that I'd like to talk about is energy efficiency, and this is very different from other things that I've mentioned so far, in the sense that it is much less controversial. I was in Moscow last week having over two dozens of meetings on energy efficiency issue, and my sense was that Russia has started to take this very seriously. They have the necessary legislation, to a large extent in place to promote this energy efficiency. And there is also an improved capacity to deal with this because they have identified the institutions to deal with them. Certainly, we can't be sure what would be the success in terms of coordinating these activities within the Russian government, but This is an area where both Europe and Russia could benefit. From Russia's perspective, it could reduce to some extent the strain that is created by its geological constraints. Basically, it needs to make huge investments in order to sustain existing levels of production, or to increase production, and to some extent by removing part of the domestic demand, by reducing it through energy efficiency, it could be very helpful from their perspective. And from Europe's perspective, obviously, it will increase its it will improve its sense of energy security, as well as that makes, that will lead to the at least it will allow a huge chunk of gas to be available for the European market. And finally, I'd like to mention that Russia's focus on, again, rediscovered focus on areas such as innovation, for instance, which is, appears as a big priority in rhetoric, at least. This is an area where which could easily be linked to energy efficiency, because energy efficiency is something that requires a major transfer of technologies especially from the West, and this brings certain opportunities where both sides could cooperate. Thank you.
Thank you, Adnan. Sigi.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk here, to speak here. And I understand that I have a very unpleasant job, because I have to explain you why there is no future in economic relations between Russia and Europe except of oil and gas. Beyond oil and gas. Really, I think it's a funny story, but at least I'm rather pessimistic on this. Let me start with the Russian crisis, with the recent crisis where Russian economy was hit most among G20 countries. Russian GDP fell by virtually 8% in 2009, and up to now there is no any significant indication of the recovery, of the economic recovery. In the second half of the last year, there was a certain growth in export sectors and export branches of Russian economy, because oil prices have increased, gas consumption in Europe has increased, metal prices have increased, and that led to growth in export sectors, while domestic industries producing goods and services for the domestic consumption, they continue to shrink. And there are, we may say that currently in Russian economy there are two sectors. One is export-oriented, as usual, it's not new. One is export-oriented, and it is growing, but not very fast. And another is domestic-oriented. On export sector, according to our estimates, it seems that Russian economy has reached its pre-crisis maximum of export capacities that was fixed at the autumn of 2007. And further on, certain growth, of course, may take place, but it will be very, very slow. On the domestic industries, as I mentioned, there is no significant improvement. Why? Why did that happen? There is a widespread view that Russian economy is dependent on oil. Yes, that's true. But the growth we saw in the second half of the previous decade, of the current decade, was not linked to oil prices. Really, from 2003-2004, when oil prices were below $30 per barrel, up to mid-2008, when oil skyrocketed to 140, seems Russian economy should benefit enormously. But that's not true, because at 90%, from 85 to 90% of increase in oil price was accumulated by the Russian budget. And it was not spent into the economy. It was accumulated into the reserve funds. That means that despite oil prices virtually has quadrupled from 2003 to 2008, Russian economy received only a small portion of those money. The growth in the economy in the 2005-2008 was linked mainly to the increase in foreign borrowings. Russian companies and Russian banks have intensified foreign borrowings, and the corporate foreign debt increased five times from the beginning of 2005 to mid-2008. As financial crisis occurred, financial markets were closed, and Russian companies were not able to borrow new money to repay old debts. Moreover, they have to repay the debts received in the previous years. And that's why this financial inflow has collapsed, And definitely many Russian industries and a lot of Russian banks, they faced the problem that they lost financial resources. Another problem that will break Russian recovery is Russian budgetary policy, and that is caused by the structural changes, significant structural changes in the Russian budget occurred in 2008, 2009, and 2010. According to the governmental decision, pensions and some social benefits have been increased significantly, and the share of direct payment to households, like wages, pensions, and different types of allowances, increased from 47% to 58% in the consolidated budget. And virtually the whole deficit of this year, the whole deficit of the federal budget, is the transfer to the pension fund to finance pensions paid to Russian people. And trying to keep the budget deficit target and trying to reduce the budget deficit in this year, next year, Russian government decided to cut investment and decided to cut current expenditures in some areas. Of course, pensions is very important, but from macroeconomic point of view, investment and current expenditures, they are much more favorable and useful for the economic growth rather than pensions. That's why, in real terms, expenditures not related to the households benefits, and they reduced by 8% in real terms this year, and since they will be cut next year as well. And that is the situation where Russian economy is. And of course, the drop in the Russian economy was so strong that Russian authorities had to react. And in mid-2009, when oil prices have recovered and it seemed that crisis is over, Russian authorities started to analyze what's going on. And as there is a different distinction of labor between Prime Minister Putin and President Medvedev, President Medvedev started to explore new ideas. He started to criticize the current economic system. He started to speak about modernization. And he said, finally, in September, he published his well-known article, Russia Go On, Russia Forward, saying, okay, Russia needs modernization. And as this article was published in the internet, in the website, the president invited the wide range of people just to discuss. And that created an euphoria in the Russian society, saying, okay, finally, here are changes, and we need change like Obama, President Obama said. But very soon, President Medvedev has clarified his slogan, saying, okay, look, modernization is not a comprehensive modernization. It's not what we are looking for. It's not the modernization of the country, of the political system, of every cell in our society. Modernization is only a technological process. We need to modernize not the economy, but several sectors in the economy, like space, like nuclear, like energy, like pharmaceuticals and computer science. So that's what is modernization. That is what modernization means currently. Moreover, there were very wide debates in Russia in autumn last year and the beginning of the winter about modernization, and a lot of experts have agreed that in order to modernize Russia, to make it contemporary, to make our country modern, there is a need to start with political modernization, with modernization of the political system. And it seems that this idea, this conclusion, and created a certain fear in the Kremlin, in the Russian White House, and the word modernization has been replaced gradually by another word, that is innovation. And if you analyze speeches of Prime Minister and of the President, you will see that they mention much often innovation rather than modernization. Is it serious? Is it serious even technological modernization? To one extent, yes, because the President has established a special commission that is meeting every month, that is traveling all over the country, meeting different companies, discussing different ideas, and approving different projects. On the other hand, the Prime Minister has established commission, his personal commission on innovation as well. But on the other hand, it should be, at least as President indicates, it should be a government-led innovation process over technological modernization. On the other hand, Russian government has decided to spend on all technological projects, on all innovative ideas, only $4 billion within coming 3 years, while Russian annual budget, Russian federal budget, is annually 240 billion euros. So you see that the government is not ready to spend money and is not ready to change the economic system. Is not ready to change rules of the game. So, and that makes me think that Russian authorities, they do not recognize very well what they want to achieve. The most interesting development in the recent time was several speeches of Prime Minister Putin, who said Russia needs foreign investment, and that it seems to me that. In the last Russia-Europe summit in Stockholm, President Medvedev made a very good advertising of Russian modernization, and European Commission is ready to support, wants to support, but Commission Europe doesn't know what to do, and it seems that Russia is currently saying, okay, let's foreign investors go to Russia. Do you really believe that European Commission can change something in this aspect? Do European Commission own some European, huge European companies and make establish their presence in Russia? Definitely not. It is decision of the companies. Why Prime Minister Putin has changed? He was in recent years in office, he was a strong opponent of foreign investment. For many years, the regulation of foreign investors was more and more restrictive. Initially, it was on case-on-case basis. Me personally, my business career, I faced two very significant plans that were failed because of that time President Putin position. One was in Kerensky Motor, that is aviation engine. Enterprise in Russia, where Pratt & Whitney, an American company, had a stake 25% and wanted to increase it up to 50%. That happened in 2003-2004. In fact, all issues, financial issues, all technological issues have been resolved, and Pratt & Whitney was ready to improve Russian aviation engine. But this deal, this transaction, was prohibited by Prime Minister Putin. And by President Putin. Another example was Silovin Machine, Power Machines, is energy equipment company that is placed in St. Petersburg. It was established by Siemens before the revolution, and Siemens was ready to acquire controlling stake in this company just to build as European platform for its operations. Once again, all commercial agreements have been reached, and finally, President Putin prohibited this transaction. So, moreover, in later years, it was in 2004-2005. Afterwards, there were several decisions of Putin who prohibited foreign penetration to oil and gas sector, and as a result, the law on foreign investment in strategic industries was adopted in 2008, it seems to me, maybe 2007. Where 42 sectors of the Russian economy were listed, and there was a general prohibition that foreigners cannot buy more than 50% in companies in those industries, while in oil and gas, this limit is 10%. All investment above those limits should be approved by a special commission that is headed by the Prime Minister, by that time Mr. Putin. And that was a significant break. That was a significant break, and several attempts were done by foreign companies to get allowances, and all of them were prohibited. And suddenly the situation started to change, first with this meeting on Yamal that Adnan said, about where Prime Minister Putin advertised for foreign investment in the gas sector. That was very, very strange, because normally the gas sector is the most closed for foreign investment. But if you look attentively, if you read what the Prime Minister suggested to foreign companies, it was not a lot. Saying, okay, you may get no more than 25% stake, But you need to invest money, you need to provide technology, you need to provide trading capabilities, you need to provide LNG, and blah, 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 and so on, everything. But you do not get more than 25% of stakes. And no management rights. All those projects will be managed by Gazprom. So it seems to me that one significant case occurred last year that shifted position of Prime Minister Putin was Avtovaz. Avtovaz is the biggest Russian car producing company that was built in 1970 and was launched in 1970. In effect, it is Fiat. Fiat enterprise built by Italians. It started to produce it Fiat 124. And since that time, it virtually degraded gradually, and it was a problem for Russian authorities after the reform because it required subsidies, support, and so on, and high custom tariffs. And in 2007, the company was acquired by today the company is called Rostechnologie. It's a state corporation, and the government. In fact, a state corporation started to manage and take management over the company. But in 2008, Avtovaz virtually has collapsed financially. By that year, Avtovaz has produced a record number of cars in its history, but every car sold produced $1,000 of losses for the company. And that was done under the government, in fact, under the state management. And the Rostechnologie, that is a dominant stakeholder in Avtovaz, is headed by a personal friend of Mr. Putin, Sergei Chemezov, who has a personal respect and trust of Putin. And he was not able to do anything. He was not able to improve the situation in the company. Moreover, Avtovaz is located in the city of Tolyatti, and the bulk of the citizens of this city, they work on Avtovaz. And in fact, that created enormous social tension in the first half of 2009. And by that time, by then, Renault has acquired a 25% stake in Avtovaz in beginning of 2008. And suddenly Renault started to support this project. Renault supported the independent new CEO of the company and started to support renovation of Avtovaz and technological development. And it seems that changed the mentality of Mr. Putin, and finally he said, okay, we need foreign investment. Moreover, President Medvedev, in his speeches on innovation, said, okay, we need to attract a foreign specialist, we need to attract foreign technologists, we need to cut the technological gap. The problem in Russia, and that is very strange for me that not a lot of outsiders recognize it, there is a usual gap between words of Russian political leaders and their actions. When they say we need foreign investment, that doesn't mean they want to improve the situation, they improve conditions, environment for foreign investment. It's not a huge secret that there are three principal obstacles for foreign investment in Russia: rule of law, corruption, and intellectual property rights. Three issues, and Russian government is doing nothing to solve these problems. Maybe Russian government will solve this problem on this in technopark that's named Skolkovo, whose surface is 4 square kilometers, because it will be a special zone. But Russian government is not ready to change rules of the game, to change economic environment all over the country, and that prohibits foreign companies, European companies, to go to Russia because it's very difficult to run business in this country. Can Europe do something in this area? In my mind, not. In my mind, definitely, European Commission may during meetings may say, okay, we need business climate to improve, we need investment environment to improve. But unless this is done, European Commission even may not advertise seriously Russia, because Russia is not attractive to foreign investment. That's my view where we are today. And moreover, it seems to me that Europe does not need a lot from Russia. There is another story, though. Okay, well, at least we know what Russia needs from Europe, at least what Russia may require. Russia would require technology. Russia would seek for some cooperation, industrial cooperation in aviation space and some military sectors. But what does Europe really need something economically from Russia except of oil and gas? My answer is, and up to now, it's not clear. It seems to me not. That's it.
Thank you, Sergei. On that note, optimistically, let's talk about European policy perspectives. Jana.
Thank you very much. I will actually pick up right there where left. Sam asked me to comment on, I quote, the scope for EU policymaking to shape a new institutionalized economic relationship with Russia. In, you know, short question, is there a scope for a workable framework for commerce between the EU and Russia? Well, the core message of my speech is that there is hardly any scope for this. But I will focus on the EU, and I will say that it is especially the case as long as the EU's energy markets are not reformed and unified. What does the EU want to achieve with Russia on the commercial front? Better market access for exports through lower tariffs. Russia is one of the most important export destinations, at least pre-crisis, for EU's manufacturing goods. Investment into Russian services, the energy sector, and manufacturing. Generally a predictable, non-discriminatory treatment based on international norms for EU exporters and investors. And of course, energy security. We all agree on this panel that Russia would benefit from this. You know, the protectionism and economic nationalism of the recent years does not serve Russia well. And the EU has loads to offer. The EU's traditional approach to post-Soviet Russia is based on the idea that it can somehow transform Russia by having it adopt much of its own norms. The main tool the EU uses in its neighborhood are rules-intensive bilateral agreements. This is what the Partnership and Cooperation Agreement of 1994 was about, the PCA. But when one has a look at the document itself, one realizes it's a simple diplomatic document with no legal bite at all. It was predictably quite ineffective. It expired in 2007. Moves to replace it with a strategic partnership agreement based on four common spaces, including an economic and trade space, have not materialized so far. Well, this is for obvious political reasons. Another reason on the economic front is that the EU does not want to conclude a trade agreement with Russia if Russia does not join the WTO first. It also wants Russia to respect basic energy charter treaty rules that regulate energy markets on market-based principles. The EU hopes, of course, that the current modernization program of the government and recent overtures to foreign investors will translate into concrete engagement with Europe. But I share Sergei's skepticism here. One must be aware that the recent economic crisis has not altered the political economy in Russia, contrary to what many people hoped. On the contrary, it has revealed the resilience of the system established under Vladimir Putin's rule. The system involves greater state monopolization of the economy, control of the energy sector, a move to more protectionism, and the use of energy as a foreign policy tool. The reserve fund established by the authorities to capture revenue from oil and gas has been useful macroeconomically to help stabilize the economy, but it also has been a good political tool to keep and the government afloat and to bail out the oligarchs that support it, along with the not-so-competitive corporations in banking, automotive, transport, to name a few, that belong to this entourage. The fundamentals of the regime remain intact. Gazprom, for example, has seen no reform at all. It still pursues policies that mix old-fashioned rent-seeking with political goals. One such example is the project to merge with Ukraine's Naftogaz. I had brought some slides with me, but I will have to do without it. Russia has, on the trade front, has average tariffs that are higher than comparable emerging economies. The trade-weighted average tariff of Russia is 11.4%, according to WTO sources. This is higher than Brazil, which is 8.6, or China, which is 4.5. World Bank scores on the business environment also show that Russia does very badly, scores quite badly compared to other very complicated emerging markets such as the same China, Brazil, India, etc. Its score on trading across borders is quite an appalling 162nd, along with many African economies. This is because of the entire customs bureaucracy there. There are also OECD indexes on the restrictiveness to FDI for services. The OECD has recently compared Russia with India, Indonesia, China on these indexes, and everything points to Russia being among the most restrictive in all of these sectors. Some countries are even worse, but generally Russia is on the very restrictive end of the spectrum. WTO accession and ideal energy charter treaty accession ratification would discipline Russia's use of trade and of energy also as a geopolitical tool. To name a few examples, there was a trade embargo on Georgia in 2006. After the Georgia war, Russia used trade also to signal its discontent with responses from neighbors. Ukraine saw its trade preferences withdrawn. Even the U.S. had to suffer a ban on its poultry export just at an interesting time. So all this would go. It would help bring down political tensions, of course, if Russia acceded to these disciplines. Russia's attempt to revive its customs union recently with Belarus and Kazakhstan are, in my view, a diversion from the issue of Russia's ultimate WTO accession. The project is not necessarily an economically sound one. A lot of studies, including one we have done on Kazakhstan a few years ago, shows that CIS members actually trade already too much with each other. They still have this old legacy of trade among quite uncompetitive firms. They should plug with the rest into the rest of the world, not into each other's uncompetitive markets. Others say that the customs union is also a sweet deal for
use this one.
A sweet deal for Russia's car industry, dairy producers, metals producers. It's also a political tool to continue to exert influence in the neighborhood. And the United States has quite rightly questioned whether the customs union is consistent with existing WTOs and regional agreements. Russia pulled out of the Energy Charter Treaty in 2009. The reason is that there was a court ruling that brought by former UKUS shareholders. The tribunal ruled that even if Russia had not yet ratified the Energy Charter Treaty, it had signed it but not ratified, it still was bound by its provisions. But there were provisional application paragraphs in the text that indeed would have forced Russia to abide by ECT rules, so Russia pulled out. WTO rules, ECT rules, serious EU free trade agreements, as they are being designed in the late last years, all demand a substantial dent to national sovereignty in the field of trade, of course. So the reason for Russia to accept the rules of the game must really be compelling. Basically, there must be real change at home that favors economic reforms. But let me compare Russia very quickly with China here. China, like Russia, is not exactly keen on letting its policies be dictated by multilateral institutions. However, it has accepted to abide by at least most WTO rules. The reason is that China's regime survival depends on strong economic growth, and in China, economic growth depends a lot on exporting cheap labor-intensive manufacturers. China needs the WTO to maximize its exports. In Russia, the calculus is different. Russia faces no barriers to speak of to its main export, and it exerts quite a lot of power in the way it organizes its gas and oil exports. Why bother with WTO ECT? WTO-induced economic reforms, when one looks at what Russia has signed up to on paper with its partners, could indeed, you know, it's quite ambitious, actually. But these reforms could disturb the country's current internal power balance. And if energy charter rules applied in Russia, Gazprom's preeminence and the Yukos nationalization could be questioned. This is a bit too regime-threatening for the moment. So all this does indeed not bode well for the EU's ambitions with Russia. So what can it do? Unless there is a substantial shift in policy in Russia, the EU, under current conditions, will not be able to start talking to it seriously unless it achieves one thing, its single market in gas. Russia has been holding sway over Europe with threats of and actual energy supply cuts. This is not so much because of an EU-wide overdependency on Russian hydrocarbons. It only accounts for about one-third of the overall EU imports. The problem is the fragmentation along national lines of the EU's gas markets. There are different levels among different countries of dependency on imports of gas from Russia. There are also different levels of collaboration with Gazprom of these different gas companies of the different countries. This leads to strong divisions within the EU and the inability to formulate a coherent approach to Russia. So only a single market based on competitive fair market rules will bring an end to this self-defeating dynamic in the EU. Adnan has mentioned the 2009 energy package. We published a paper earlier this year that has looked at it quite in detail. Well, the EU Commission has tried to achieve the single market, but the package does not achieve its goal. Brussels has failed to make member states fully dismantle their gas monopolies, and what is the most scary is that the countries that need gas market reform most are in Central and Eastern Europe, and that's where most exemptions to any sort of unbundling rules or competition rules are. Latvia and Estonia are completely exempted. It's interesting because Gazprom has almost 30% shares in the local gas monopolies, so that says a lot of what is going on in these countries. You know, the EU, as long as these features remain in the EU, there will be no single voice and no credibility when the EU discusses with Russia. To conclude, back to, you know, given that there's a summit very soon and the still stated ambition for a strategic partnership, let me look a bit into the substance if both parties ever get there. Then I would say that the EU would need to insist on strong investment protection, strong dispute settlement provisions for trade, of course, and investment, including probably investor-state arbitration. The EU, until the Lisbon Treaty before the Lisbon Treaty, was not able to propose this in these agreements, but the Lisbon Treaty now gives new powers to the EU Commission to do so. So there is more scope for this. It will take some time for the EU to clarify legal hurdles to achieve this, but it's on its way. So that should be the precondition to start discussing, you know, more deeper economic relationships. But this is not only to protect only European interests. It's also good for Russia. It would improve the investment climate at home. It would improve the credibility of modernization and other programs if they are really serious. And also it would help improve conditions for investment for Russian companies themselves, who often complain also of protectionism. So having tribunals instead of politics sorting this out would dramatically improve bilateral economic relations. That's what I had to say.
Thank you. I think we've had from all three speakers a very good overview of the sort of incentives and imperatives that are driving economic decision making and cross border policy making in Europe and in Russia, and on the constraints and how far policymakers can really take that. I'd like to open now the floor up to questions, and I think, in the interest of time, what we'll do is we'll collect maybe three or four questions and then present those to the panel, and then we have time to go again. So please, and please identify yourself when you ask.
Hi, Klaus Hecking from Financial Times Deutschland. One question, Mr. Alekhashenko, and it was, you mentioned this case after was. I didn't get who was the investor, and could you just go a little bit more into detail what this new investor changed, and just explain a little bit about that. Thanks.
André Gerrits, I'm with the University of Amsterdam and the Netherlands Institute of International Relations. I have a question to Sergei, too. You refer to this gap between words and deeds. We're all familiar with that, I guess. But I was wondering, why would there be this gap in the case of foreign direct investment? In other words, why would the Russian government be interested in pretending to be open to increasing the opportunities for foreign direct investment, while in reality they are not? Why this gap in this specific field?
Other questions? Well, why don't we start with those, both to Sergei again, on the Avtovaz deal and on the gap between words and deeds in FDI.
You see, I think that the gap exists not only in this area, but everywhere. And in many areas of government's policy. In foreign direct investment, it seems to me that Russian authorities have recognized that it is not possible to reduce technological gap between Russia and Europe, Russia and the United States. It's not possible to increase the quality of Russian goods produced in Russia. It's not possible to increase export potential of Russian companies without bringing FDI. And it seems as well, Russian authorities have recognized that FDI is not money. Russia has a lot of money. It's not an issue of money. FDI is technology, is knowledge, is management. In order to bring this, you have to accept that they will come. And that's why both Prime Minister and the President say we need FDI. That's true. Russia needs FDI. But in order FDI come to Russia, the words that Russia needs is not enough. We need actions. That's it. But
why are there no actions?
As soon as you start to solve problems of rule of law and corruption and intellectual property rights, you need to change comprehensively change political and economic system, and that's what Russian authorities doesn't want to happen. Yeah, their primary goal is to keep the system, political system as it is, and the economic system as it is. They are not ready to fight corruption. They are not ready to implement rule of law. But they recognize that those issues are key issues of the Russian society. And they accept, yes, that are problems. And we, as President Medvedev, said, yes, we will start to fight corruption. We have approved several laws. And maybe we shall win in 15 years. Okay, I do not trust in such a policy. Either you start immediately and you want to fight it right now, maybe 2 years, maybe 15 years, but you have to fight. Words is not enough. You need actions. That's because any actions we would change the system. On Avtovaz, the minority stakeholder, not minority, the 25% stakeholder in Avtovaz is Renault, French company.
Ah.
Renault, yes. And Renault has purchased a stake in the beginning of 2008, paid more than 1 billion euros for this stake. In anti-crisis plan, Renault has agreed to provide a platform for the car production in Avtovaz. Renault has agreed to provide equipment, and to use afterwards facilities to produce cars under Renault and Nissan brands. So the idea is to transform afterwards capacities, let's say maybe in 3 years sooner, into the company that will produce similar cars under three brands, Renault, Nissan, and afterwards. And that's why, and that means virtually it will be similar cars, very similar cars on the same platform with same components, but three brands. And that is the assistance of Renault.
Was it the company that in old USSR times produced Moscovich?
No, it produced Zhiguli. Lada. Lada. Not Moscovich, but Lada.
Who is the CEO now?
Igor Komarov. Of AvtoVAZ, yeah?
Adam, please.
Well, I just want to add, regarding your question, why such a gap between words and deeds? Now, I guess the main reason for the gap, and I see two reasons. First of all, it's really difficult to turn words into deeds in a lot of areas. As my colleague mentioned, it will require a major change in the how Russian economy works and in the political game as well. The other thing is the Russian leadership actually benefits from lack of clarity. Instead of having a comprehensive reform for related to foreign investors, by establishing clear independent judiciary, for instance, clear rules for property rights. I mean, from their perspective, it is quite often much more beneficial to leave some uncertainty so that they can deal on a personal basis with big investors, for instance. I mean, it always gives them more power to deal with them. And that is one of the explanations why this gap will remain for a while.
Thank you. More questions?
Sorry, I've got another one. In a few days, we're going to have this EU-Russia summit. Do you think FDI will be the main issue, or what is going to be the main issue of the summit? Ooh, I don't know, anyone?
Would you like to address that?
Yeah. So, I'm not sure. That it is too early to talk seriously about FDI liberalization, FDI rules between the EU and Russia. Many people, including myself, expect that it's going to be a rather empty summit, photo op, good climate, you know, trying to bring in a more positive climate between both sides. Both sides are keen on doing it, but I don't expect much substance. Seems talks right now are focused on issues like visa facilitation, etc., that you can sort. These are relatively easy things to do. Hard talk, serious talk on FDI, let's say it's too early.
Thank you. Please.
Marta Jezowska, I'm a stagiaire at the European Commission. I wanted to ask the panelists whether they thought that the developing, not-so-recent Russia-Venezuela relationship is actually going to be taken any further and what kind of effect it could have on relations with the EU.
Who wants to address that easy question?
It's oil and gas.
Well, I guess that's, very hard... hard to answer what will be the future evolution of that relationship, but I'm just thinking that the two countries are not really able to complement each other. I mean, they are facing the same problems. Russia is a very high cost producer for oil and also for gas. Venezuela is a high producer and actually produces much lower quality of oil, and they both need foreign investment, and they have serious problems about being able to attract foreign investments. I mean, by two countries who really cannot really help much each other. That's my impression. It could be, from some of the Russian companies' perspective, it could be an opportunity for them to diversify somewhat and to expand some of their upstream operations, maybe in Venezuela, and there have been some attempts already. But I don't see really that this is going to turn into a huge strategic partnership in any way. And besides that, Venezuela is part of OPEC, Russia is not part of OPEC. So, I mean, I'm sure there will be like serious disagreements, even if they want to act jointly in certain areas.
I think that Russia-Venezuela relations, they started several years ago as a poison pill for United States. And it's definitely the question for the second panel. As relationship between Russia and U.S. started to change, and at least Russia seems, as I recognize, seems try to avoid certain new conflicts or tensions with the United States, there is a need to move from political cooperation with Venezuela towards something else. And in this area, okay, Russia is happy to supply weapons and armaments to Venezuela, and of course Russian companies would like to get access to Venezuelan oil, because there are not a lot of places in the world where you can get access to non-developed reserves. And that's why Russian companies, they're active in Iraq and Venezuela. But on political issue, you should ask the second session.
Please.
Dmitry Shkurko, National News Agency of Ukraine. I just, you know, during last few months, we observed quite intense development in the relations between Ukraine and Russia, and obviously, it is not only about the marriage of Naftogaz and Gazprom, but about a much wider spectrum of cooperation, including atomic cooperation, space, shipbuildings, aviation, and so on. But maybe if EU did not use that Ukrainian assets, it does not meet its interests enough. So that I can approximately imagine what does it mean for Ukraine from Ukrainian side, but let us look to those process from the Russian side, from their side. What does it mean for ability of Russia for internal reforms? How that stimulate those in economical integration with the close neighbors in wider sense, not only with Ukraine, to stimulate internal development, political, economical, and all kinds of development in Russia. Thanks.
Take that.
Could you specify by what you mean exactly by internal developments? Who is affected by whom? I wasn't clear.
Okay, we are speaking now about the potential for reforms inside
mm-hmm.
Russia.
Okay.
Recreation of so-called post-Soviet space, both economical and political terms, how that stimulate internal development in Russia? Will it stimulate or not? That is the question.
Okay, in my mind, it will not affect. It will not affect Russian domestic situation, because definitely Russian government is seeking for cooperation in aviation and in nuclear. But on both sides, on both areas, on the Russian side, there are state-controlled companies. So I do not see a significant improvement in domestic climate. Moreover, Russia is looking for investment into Ukraine to get access to Ukrainian companies, because definitely I think that this cooperation makes sense for both sides. But it is Russian. It's a question of Russian investment to Ukraine, not Ukrainian investment to Russia.
Mm.
Yeah. So we are not treating Ukraine as an investor to Russia. We are Russian sources. Yeah. They are not treating the investment climate in Russia. So in my mind, what definitely from political point of view is definitely Putin and Medvedev would like to have closer relations with the Ukraine, economic and political, because that helps them to keep the image that they are able to reestablish, if not the Soviet Union, but the Soviet space. Yeah, that's from
is it trophy?
From historical point of view, it seems to me it's counterproductive. It's counterproductive because the country is looking backward, not forward. But from their political point of view, it's the right thing, because a lot of their voters, they support this idea.
Well, I guess what I can add is, I mean, there will be certain limits for Russia in this endeavor for greater cooperation. I mean, I'm just thinking about the gas sector, for instance. I think Putin probably overplayed Russia's hand in that case. He was acting too fast with too many proposals in a very short period of time. He could have spread this over a certain amount of time, and he created a very large backlash. I mean, some of his proposals could have come in a very phased manner. I am not sure why that was not calculated on their part, but it has already led to some reaction. And another restraint there is the biggest users of Russian gas are some industries such as chemicals and steel. And the owners of these are very powerful people politically. I mean, they have interest for strong cooperation with Russia, but in the meantime, they don't have interest for paying European prices to Russia. So, I mean, that by itself could be a source of conflict in the future and also could strain, to some extent, their relations. And regarding repercussions on Russia itself, I mean, Russia is a very different country from Ukraine to a large extent. You don't have the same level of political competition in Russia. So as long as Russia itself doesn't change for various internal reasons, I don't think the relationship with Ukraine would really matter too much.
And the last question in the back, please.
Daniil Bochkarev with Stress Institute. Question for Adnan and Sergei concerning the changing dynamics in the gas producers' landscape in Russia. Do you see any like concrete role for independent gas producers to be played? Like, I'm especially talking about Novatek and recent attempts of Timchenko, for instance, getting into the capital of Novatek, and a number of like independent gas producers being linked to oil companies or to Rosneft. And let's say, like, do you see any future for them? And I say, what will be their role in the next decade to come?
Independent gas producers.
Sure. It's a good question. It's a good question. On the one hand, I have no clear answer. I have no clear answer because definitely it is a fight between Gazprom, that means for Russia more than General Motors for the United States, and Gazprom is monitored, supervised, and managed by Mr. Putin personally and very closely. On the other hand, Novatek is a company where Gazprom has 20% stake. On the other hand, Mr. Timchenko, who is a close friend of Mr. Putin, has 22% stake in this company. And Mr. Sechin, who is Deputy Prime Minister in charge of industry and in particular of the oil and gas sector, is the head of the is chairman of the board of directors in Rosneft, that is competing oil company, but as well in Interrao, that is gas consumption, gas consuming power producing company. And it is very interesting to see this bureaucratical fight between Gazprom and Mr. Sechin in different angles. On the one hand, there is a government resolution allowing describing how independent producers can get access to Gazprom, to pipelines of Gazprom, is prepared and agreed by everyone and is on the table of Mr. Putin for more than 6 months. And Sechin personally is lobbying this decision to be signed because he is defending interests of oil companies and Rosneft, that is a state-controlled company, in particular. On the other hand, and he has no success. On the other hand, Sechin, being the chairman of Interrao, has insisted this company to break the contract with Gazprom on gas purchases and sign the contract with Novatek. And that's why that gave a certain space to Novatek and the domestic market. The crucial question in answering your question, yes, it seems that consolidated power of independent oil producers should grow, and they should press Russian government. Moreover, if Gazprom will not be able to keep production on the current levels in the future. On the other hand, it is evident that in coming years, domestic market for Gazprom will be much more lucrative rather than European market, because competition in European market with LNG is growing. If shale gas will emerge in Poland or in Germany or in France, it will be even tighter competition. And Gazprom definitely had worse terms, lower prices in 3-5 years, Gazprom will have lower prices in Europe rather than in Russia, where it has no competitors and where it keeps dominant position. Currently, and brains of Gazprom, today Gazprom defends export market. But if there are people who have strategical view in Gazprom, they should recognize that maybe it's better to allow independent producers to go to export markets and to keep domestic market. But today, domestic market is less profitable. So it seems to me, in long run, independent producers will get bigger share in the gas market. But it will be a very interesting fight, and not all of them will benefit. For example, 3 or 4 months ago, Lukoil, that is the second biggest Russian oil company, has decided that it's not expanding its Russian operations. Yeah, it's trying to move the investment outside of Russia because they do not see opportunities to increase production in a domestic country. So the outcome is unpredictable.
Well, that was a very comprehensive answer, so there is little left to add to that, but just to maybe 2 points. It is the rise of independent gas producers in Russia. One probably needs to look at it as part of intra-elite competition. Now, you mentioned Timchenko. Obviously, we are talking about competing elites within Russia. And part of this newly rising elite like Timchenko, who is basically an elite from the last decade rather than the 90s, they will have a strong interest to legitimize the wealth that they have gathered in the past decade. And one way to do that is the gas business, to get increasingly involved in that gas business. So that actually leads to, that could be an indication that there will be strong pressures for powerful players to get involved in that, as Timchenko is. Now, but for a very, for a comprehensive solution, you need a major legislative change, and this hasn't been happening for so many years. I have doubts that this can happen very soon because, the domestic market pays less, for instance, than the foreign market, but it's still a lucrative market, and I'm not sure that Gazprom would like to give up with that soon.
Thank you. We have run over time already and taken time from the coffee break, and that's from the next session. We will, of course, be revisiting a lot of these issues as we talk about security and international relations in the next panel. So I'd like to thank all of our panelists for their contributions, all of you for your questions, and we will return to the table at 10:45. Thank you.